I, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.
A conversation about raising sons is coming up in the next hour of Forum. After a traffic update, there is some trouble in Fremont, and Michael Bennett has the details. Hey, Michael.
Hey, Michelle. Southbound 880 in Fremont, right at Mowry Avenue. Have reports of a hit-and-run crash. Don't have any more information yet. Highway Patrol's on the way out there to fill in the blanks. Northbound 680 at Stone Ridge Drive in Pleasanton. Watch out. Stalled Big Rig. That is taking up the two left-hand lanes. I'm Michael Bennett for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose philanthropy includes Schmidt Ocean Institute, advancing the frontiers of ocean science, exploration, and discovery. On the web at schmidtocean.org. I'm Michelle Hennigan. The second hour of Forum is just ahead. And then at 10 o'clock tonight on the Commonwealth Club, a conversation about artificial intelligence in education. This is KQED San Francisco, KQEI North Highland, Sacramento. It's 9 o'clock.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Leslie McClurg in today for Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, Ruth Whitman is the mother of three boys. And when she was pregnant with her third son, she was, quote, frightened both for and of the tiny piece of patriarchy growing inside me. Worried sick over what he and his brothers might become. The potential for darkness that I might be powerless to stop. She wrestles with that fear in her new book, Boy Mom. Interviewing psychologists, social workers, even trying to understand what's driving sexual predators. We hear what she learned about her power to raise good men in what she calls an impossible age of masculinity. That's next after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Shea Stevens. President Biden helped honor the veterans of the D-Day invasion of Normandy, France, which helped end World War II in Europe. Speaking at a cemetery where more than 9,000 U.S. soldiers are buried, Biden called the battles in Normandy a lesson that he hopes Americans never forget.
Hitler and those with him thought democracies were weak, that the future belonged to dictators. Here, the coast of Normandy, the battle between freedom and tyranny would be joined. Here, on that June morning, the testing was at hand.
Biden also says that World War II proved that democratic ideals of the West are stronger than any army or coalition forces around the world. The Israeli military has used an American-made bomb in a deadly airstrike on a UN school in Gaza. NPR's Daniel Estrin has more from Tel Aviv.
Israel's army said it targeted several dozen militants plotting attacks from inside a UN school in central Gaza. The army said it was unaware of any civilian casualties. But a Gaza hospital director told NPR the strike killed at least 32 people, including seven children, sheltering in the school. NPR's producer in Gaza, Anas Baba, videotaped remnants of the bomb at the school. U.S. weapons experts identified it as a U.S.-made precision munition intended to cause low collateral damage. The Pentagon had no comment, but one Pentagon official told NPR that Israel had used the bomb improperly because of the high number of casualties. The official spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss Israel's conduct. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The Florida Department of Education is being sued over a new law that plaintiffs say pits parents against one another. The parents of three children are challenging a statute that requires local school boards to adopt policies that allow parents to oppose reading material in school libraries. They say the law discriminates against parents who oppose book bans and amounts to censorship. SpaceX has completed another successful test of its giant Starship rocket. Details from NPR's Jeff Brumfield.
The enormous Starship rumbled off its pad in Texas. From there, it separated from its massive booster rocket and cruised through space for roughly an hour before re-entering Earth's atmosphere. Live views showed flaps on the Starship glowing red as it endured a punishing re-entry, but incredibly, they were still able to control the spacecraft, which SpaceX says landed in the ocean.
From South Texas to the other side of the Earth, Starship is in the water.
Starship may one day carry astronauts to the moon and even Mars. Today's test is a major milestone for the program. Jeff Brumfiel, NPR News.
U.S. futures are flat in after-hours trading. This is NPR. A judge in Missouri has erased the misdemeanor convictions of a St. Louis couple who pointed guns at racial injustice protesters in 2020. Mark and Patricia McCloskey insisted that the demonstrators marching past their home were trespassing. They were pardoned in 2021. Mark McCloskey now wants the city to return his AR-15 rifle and his wife's pistol. The new chief executive of the Washington Post is accused of trying to kill a story to protect his own reputation. Will Lewis denies similar allegations involving a scandal at Rupert Murdoch's tabloids, where he worked over a decade ago. Lewis is also accused of trying to interfere with this network's reporting on his past work, as NPR's David Folkenflik reports.
Lewis has denied all wrongdoing and told then-executive editor Sally Busby she shouldn't cover the allegations. A spokesperson for Lewis tells NPR that is not true. Nonetheless, according to several people at the Post, Busby was shaken by his interceding. On Sunday night, 3.5 weeks after the Post published a thorough look at the allegations, Lewis announced he was replacing Busby as part of a restructuring. Back in December, when I first broke news of the accusations, Lewis repeatedly and heatedly offered me an exclusive interview with him about the Post's future, but only if I drop my story. Lewis's spokesperson declined comment on that, the same spokesperson who affirmed the offer back in December. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
Wall Street stocks closed mostly lower. The Dow gained 78 points. The Nasdaq lost 14, and the S&P 500 dipped a single point. U.S. futures are flat in after-hours trading. I'm Shay Stevens. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Jane Gross, whose bequest supports NPR's commitment to creating a more informed public by distributing programming that meets the highest standards of public service and journalism. This is NPR.
Make this summer unforgettable with KQED's Summer Guides. From thrilling concerts to captivating art shows, we've got your guide to all the must-see events. Explore more at kqed.org/summerguide2024. The temperatures were slightly cooler today. Expect a further cool down into the weekend. The National Weather Service says another warming trend is on the way for early next week. It's 9:06. This is KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Leslie McClurg. I'm in today for Mina Kim. And when Ruth Whitman was pregnant, and she's in studio with me right now, and she was pregnant with her third son, it was the height of the Me Too movement. And she feared for her youngest son that he would grow up to be, quote, a rapist, school shooter, incel, man-child, interrupter, mansplainer, boob-starer, birthday forgetter, frat boy, dude bro, homophobe, self-important stoner, emotional labor abstainer, non-wiper of kitchen counters, end quote. But as she dove into the world of hypermasculinity, she uncovered some real truths and really helpful research that is now helping her work with, not against, masculinity, and she feels a lot more well-equipped to raise good sons. She also has advice on how to create a more gender-equitable world for all of us. Welcome to Forum, Ruth.
Thanks so much for having me.
So when you were pregnant, we kind of hinted there, you were a little bit nervous about having your third son, and society seemed to also send you some messages that you should be nervous. So what kind of messages were you receiving even before your son was born?
Yeah, so I think there was a general kind of negativity about boys in the air anyway, even before the Me Too movement kind of exploded. And, you know, I was seeing all these articles in places like the New York Times and the Huffington Post, which were things like, it's a boy and it's okay to be disappointed. And, you know, I would say, you know, people would look at my pregnancy bump and be like, I hope that one's a girl. You know, they'd see me with two boys. And I'd be like, no, it's a boy. And they would kind of respond as if I'd said, you know, I was going off to war or something. You know, it was just this real sense that, you know, that girls were maybe more of a prize in this moment. And then when I was right about to give birth, the Me Too movement just absolutely took off. And it was just, you know, I'd look at my my phone app, and there would just be this rolling horror show of bad news about men. You know, it was just sex offenders, it was incels, it was right-wingers, it was Trump, it was all of these things. And, you know, it just was a very, very fraught time to be raising three boys. And we were suddenly talking about it as if it was, you know, a systemic problem. I think there'd been a tendency before to see all these sort of acts of sexual violence as kind of, you know, just these bad apples or these one-off problems. But suddenly we were talking about it in terms of this really big systemic problem with men. So, you know, it was scary.
Absolutely. And before you were mothering sons, it sounds like you really had the thought, or, you know, were really holding true that you had a lot of power to just raise good boys. If you were a good, loving mother, then you would have good, well-behaved, calm boys. And that didn't seem to be playing out as you hoped. Roughhousing was going on a lot in your household. So how did you wrestle with that sort of nurture nature question?
Well, I think there was a lot of pressure. You know, I'd grown up with a version of feminism that was really very much, you know, gender is socialized, you know, everything. Boys only behave badly because we let them behave badly. You know, that this whole boys will be boys narrative, it's this kind of enabling narrative that means that we let boys get away with things. And the reason why girls tend to behave better, and there is plenty of data to support that, but the reason why that happens is because we hold girls to higher standards. So I was, you know, when I went into this whole parenting thing, I had all this hubris. I was like, oh, you know, I just won't socialize them that way. I won't let them get away with anything. And, you know, they had other ideas. I was really blindsided by how physical, how active, how rowdy my sons were. And it was so different. I grew up as one of two sisters, and we were very bookish, and we, you know, did cello practice, and we were really well behaved. And suddenly my boys are absolutely running wild. And in a way, I felt like I'd walked into my own ideological trap. You know, if boys behave badly, it's just because we let them. So therefore, the fact that my boys are behaving badly must be my fault.
And so what were you doing to try to wrangle them in? What strategies were you using to try to change what was happening inside your house?
I mean, I was trying everything. At one point, I was reading probably two parenting books a week on my Kindle. And, you know, we tried positive parenting. We tried being stricter. We tried more timeouts. We tried less timeouts. And, you know, all this research, all these books are pretty contradictory. You know, there's so many different views on, and, you know, on how to do all this stuff. And they kind of but all come with this sense of, like, if you're not doing it our way, then, you know, you're being somehow abusive or neglectful, or, you know. And so the guilt was astonishing. And, you know, I think there's this tone in American parenting generally now, which is just that we have this huge amount of control, that we can socialize the exact child that we want. And you know, in this context where there was this whole wider conversation about toxic masculinity, it was so loaded, you know, it became extra loaded. You know, there was this idea that it was kind of on me to solve this problem of toxic masculinity, and I was seeing my son's behavior very much through that lens.
Were any of these strategies making any difference?
No, nothing was making a blind bit of difference for a while. You know, we had just, you know, I gave birth to a third kid, and I think my two oldest sons were, you know, they were jealous, they were dysregulated, they were extra wild. You know, they'd been physically wild anyway. And I think, you know, this disruption of having a new brother, it was just crazy. And, you know, I would sort of be at the school gates for pickup, and, you know, one boy would be running off in another direction, and then they'd be hitting each other. And I would feel so ashamed, like everybody was looking at me. And, you know, it was a tricky time.
Luckily, it sounds like you turned to some research that was helpful to sort of understand. Talk about what you learned from Alan Shore at UCLA.
Oh, so the work of Alan Shore. So I started looking into the whole science of sex differences. And this body of research is quite sketchy in a way. There's many, many, many studies on sex differences, and people tend to co-opt them to use, you know, for different agendas. So feminists will co-opt them to say that there are no innate sex differences, and other people will co-opt them to say a completely different narrative. But what was most striking to me was that Alan Shore is a neuroscientist and a psychoanalyst, and his research, or some of his research, focuses on infants, on baby boys. And he says in a very influential paper that a baby boy is born about a month to 6 weeks behind a baby girl in development, and especially in right brain development. So, you know, brains are complicated and it's easy to oversimplify, but basically our right brains are our emotional centers. So they handle, you know, emotional self-regulation, forming attachments, forming relationships. And because boys' brains are born more immature, they're more vulnerable to disruption in those early months. So a baby girl on average, you know, these are population level averages, but on average is born with a more resilient, more independent right brain. So baby boys kind of need more support and care from their caregivers than baby girls because of this innate vulnerability. But because of our sort of ideas around masculinity and what baby boys are, we tend to parent them in kind of the opposite direction. So we tend to kind of give them less nurturing care than we give to girls. So it becomes this double whammy that they're more emotionally sensitive and fragile than infant girls. But we tend to see them as tougher, stronger, more robust, more angry, and all of those things. And so we sort of give them less engagement with that emotional side of things.
And then it sort of also doubled down when you learned about undercare. What is undercare?
Yeah, so undercare, this is very subtle. I don't want to overstate it, but I think there's, you know, people project different things. They sort of masculinize baby boys and they project masculine qualities onto them. So they, you know, there's research that shows that when a baby boy cries, adults perceive him as being angry, say, whereas when a baby girl cries, they perceive her as being sad or in distress. And people handle boys more roughly, you know, they jiggle them around and they bicycle their legs and they do all that sort of like roughhousing, you know, right from birth. And they sort of handle baby girls in a more kind of caretaking, tender way. And so the idea of undercare is just, and then as they get older, or actually, well, really right from birth, people talk, engage with girls more about their emotions. They talk to them using more emotion words. They listen to their feelings more. They're more comfortable with their displays of emotion. And so this all builds into this picture where, you know, girls are receiving more of that kind of emotional engagement and nurturing.
And so once you learned that and you understood that it was really relevant, especially to their brains, did you change, did you use that strategy and start to really address your boys with a lot more tenderness and a lot more emotional engagement?
Yes, absolutely. Because I think it really helped me, because I think we got used to seeing these problems as like discipline problems, you know, that they're behavioral problems and we need to crack down on them. And especially with this whole narrative around toxic masculinity. And as a feminist, I sort of felt this huge pressure that I had to discipline my boys out of this behavior or they'd turn into these masculine, you know, terrible people down the line. And, you know, so, and I think there's this idea that we need to be harsher with boys. We need to punish them for this kind of behavior. And actually, when I reframed it in my mind as an issue of sensitivity and vulnerability, you know, the whole boys will be boys narrative sort of talks about, you know, it's almost like an excuse to do less parenting. It's like, boys will be boys, so let's just let them get on with it. But when you see it as a, you know, when you frame it as actual vulnerability and sensitivity, it's actually an invitation to do more of that caregiving. And it allowed me to, you know, to just see my boys' behavior with a very empathetic lens and to just sort of try to look at the feelings that were driving it.
And how did they respond? Did the roughhousing or the sort of rambunctiousness, any of that change?
I mean, they were still very physical, but I think that the kind of battles that we were having when they would have these kind of angry meltdowns and I would punish them or like put them in time out or that kind of thing, when I just was approached it more by giving them a hug and being empathetic, then they really did actually respond well to it. And it did kind of diffuse the situation. And I think it's something more subtle than, it's not just like, here's a set of techniques that you can apply. It's almost like a very different orientation in your relationship with them, which really did make a difference. I think it strengthened our bond, strengthened our relationship, and helped them to see me as somebody on their side rather than somebody who was battling against them.
We're talking with Ruth Whitman about her new book, Boy Mom, Reimagining Boyhood in the Age of Impossible Masculinity. We're touching on subjects that are really crucial to raising our little guys into good men. How do we do that in this very polarized time? We want to hear from you. What does it mean to raise good sons? How are you as a moms out there? How are you doing that? What were you told growing up as you were a boy? What kind of messages did you receive? How are you talking to your sons about masculinity? We want to hear from you. Give us a call now at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can also email your comments or your questions to forum@kqed.org, or you can find us on any of our social channels, Twitter, X, Instagram, Discord. Do that now, and we'll be right back after this break.
Whether people are prepared or not, the artificial intelligence revolution is coming to education. Join us as Khan Academy founder Sal Khan returns to our program for a first look at how AI will affect learning and parenting, and how we can harness its power for good. Sal Khan talks with Adam Loschinsky on the next Commonwealth Club radio show. Hear all about it tonight at 10 p.m. on KQED.
Enhance your home with the power of voice. Ask your smart speaker to play KQED and enjoy rich, informative content. The announcers and technical staff of KQED Radio are affiliated with the National Association of Broadcast Employees and Technicians, CWA Local 51, AFL-CIO. I'm Michelle Hennigan. You're listening to the rebroadcast of this morning's forum, so the producers are not here to take your phone calls tonight. It's 9:20. And this is KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Leslie McClurg. I'm in today for Mina Kim. And we're talking about what it would mean to reimagine boyhood, masculinity, and really meaningfully address the crisis of male loneliness and what it takes to raise a good son in today's environment. We're joined by Ruth Whitman. She's an essayist, a cultural critic, and the author of a new book, Boy Mom, Reimagining Boyhood in the Age of Impossible Masculinity. And we want to hear from you. What does it mean to raise a good son? What were you told growing up? What kind of messages did you get as a little boy? How are you talking to your sons about masculinity now? Email your comments and your questions to forum@kqed.org, or find us on our social channels. We're at KQED Forum, or call us at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. A listener writes, as a child psychologist doing parenting workshops, I often reminded participants that when it comes to emotions, kids come that way. Much of the temperament is there. We must make the best of it. Would you agree, raising your little guys?
Do you know, I find that such a comforting statement in a way. I think there's so much pressure when you start with the belief that you can just raise the exact child you want and you just have to do all the right things, then it comes with this huge like sense of responsibility and pressure and self-doubt, and actually I find that really comforting to think, you know, they are the way they are and you can help them to become the best version of themselves. And that really does ring true in terms of who my kids are and who they're becoming, and working with that rather than against it.
And then you have the wider messages that are coming in from society. So it's like who they are, and then there is obviously, I think, some influence from society. So, you know, coming out of the Me Too movement, what do you think the primary messages have been from the left?
Well, I think this is a really, really tricky conversation, because after Me Too, there was understandably this just kind of outpouring of anger towards men from women. And I was, you know, I participated in that, and, you know, and it's motivated by very, very real things. You know, there has been this very genuine systemic male harm. But I think it's kind of curdled into this sense of this very punitive culture against boys. You know, we've almost sort of written them off before they've started. And there's this idea that boys are these kind of predators in waiting, that they're just kind of, you know, that the best we can do is limit the harm, limit the damage. And I think that there's almost this sort of silencing thing that's coming from the left at the moment, which is just like, boys, you've had your turn, you know, there's male privilege, you need to shut up and let everybody else speak, you know, all these more marginalized groups. And I think it comes from a really good place that we're trying for equality, but I think it's not a very helpful framing. We're talking about children, you know, we're talking about developing children, and I think there's this tone which is not very empathetic towards boys. I think, you know, the system of patriarchy that oppresses women is also oppressing men. These norms and expectations that we put on boys to be masculine, to squash their emotions, to be tough, are really harmful for them as well. And I would love to see the left kind of embrace that thinking and, you know, to see us all as in it together rather than seeing it as this kind of, you know, if you're on the left, you support girls and women, whereas if you're on the right, you support men and boys. I think that's a, you know, a polarization which is really unhelpful.
And almost that if you support women, that you should step back and basically not have any say or opinions, or that your voice is taking up space that should be taken up by a females or, like you said, a marginalized group.
Right, absolutely. And I think, you know, so you can see where that logic comes from. And I think there is some truth in it, in the sense that we tend to listen to male opinions and give them more value than female opinions in our culture. But what we haven't done is listen to male feelings in the same way that, you know, so I think what ends up happening is because male opinions get all this, you know, attention and outsized value, it's very easy for boys and men to kind of recast their painful feelings into these toxic opinions.
Into
mansplaining, or even these kind of toxic trends that you see in the manosphere, you know, or online, you know, these misogynistic views or angry, resentful political views.
Right. And what kind of messages are they getting from the right?
Well, from the right, so I think we're kind of, a lot of boys, I interviewed lots of different boys, and I think that they were feeling that they were kind of being shut down from both sides. So on the one hand, you've got the narrative from the left, which is be quiet, you know, you're taking up space that should be occupied by somebody more marginalized. And on the right, you've got this kind of man up, squash your emotions, be a man, you know, be tough. And so they couldn't really express their feelings in that context. So I think they just didn't know how to be. I think they felt very, very shut down. And a lot of boys in this generation are becoming quite avoidant, and they're becoming increasingly reclusive. And when I talk to boys, that seemed to be a theme that was coming up over and over again, which is just like, nobody wants us to speak. Nobody's listening.
Let's go to our audience. Miriam in Vallejo, you're on the air.
Ruth, thank you so much for this. I appreciate you guys and what you guys are speaking about today. I am a mother of a 21-month-old boy. I only had brothers. My husband only has a brother. I grew up in a Hispanic and Arab home, so men had a voice. And we were treated very differently, my siblings and I, and it created huge resentment from myself to my brothers and my brothers to me, because I was treated, quote unquote, more delicately. And as a mother of a boy now, I want to know, what is the best way, if I were to have a second child and it be a girl, how can I balance that? I don't want to repeat, you know, and I don't want to say my parents made mistakes, but if they knew better, they would have done better, right? So what can I do if I were to have a girl?
So,
as a second child.
Thank you so much for your comments. I mean, I think that what I learned from doing all this research is that it's important to kind of just be aware of the kind of innate biases that we all have, you know, when we look at female children and male children. So, and to kind of attempt to correct for them a little bit. So I think it's just being careful that we're not, you know, treating girls more delicately, and that we're giving that same level of care to boys. And then we're not sending boys these harmful messages to like man up and squash their emotions. And we're giving them the same level of emotional engagement that we give to girls. And also that we, you know, that we don't underestimate girls or patronize them or let them, you know, underestimate their abilities, which are also very real things, you know, keep them too sheltered. I think it's just about awareness about these biases that do exist in all of us, and just trying to correct for those.
You've talked about, Ruth, sort of a half-done revolution, and I feel that personally in relation to what Miriam was saying. My brother was raised to do things with his hands, and he's very capable, and to this day, and I was told to get out of the way. And I think a little girl raised today would not have that same experience. She would be taught to use the hammer, and she would be taught to drive the car, etc. But we haven't done that with little boys in the same way of offering them the emotional nurturing. And that's the other side of the revolution, correct?
Yes. So I think obviously the work with girls and women is not complete. And there are many ways in which this society is still very, very sexist. And, you know, there are terrible things happening with women's rights. But what I meant by that was that we've done all this great work with sort of unpacking the harmful sexist messages we send girls about their capabilities, about what who they can be, about their roles, about body image, all of these sorts of things. And we've tried really hard to correct for it. So, you know, if you go to the bookstore, you'll see, you know, 20 different books, which are like Mighty Girls, Supreme Court Justice Girls, Scientist Girls, you know, trying to give them access to those kind of traditionally masculine fields and qualities. But you will not see the equivalent of like relational boy, you know, friendship boy, nurturing boy. There's very little work. And I think we have a real kind of blind spot about it. And also it's about the way that we talk about boys and girls now in this moment. I think we've developed this really sort of inspirational way of talking about girls, which is great. You know, you hear all this, you know, the future is female. You can be anything. You can do anything a boy can be. But we still tend to, and even on the left, even progressives still use this very essentializing language about boys. I hear it all the time, you know. Boys are like dogs, you know, that's something that I hear a lot. It's just, you know, they just need food and exercise and just, you know, they're uncomplicated, just wear them out and that's all you need to do. Or like, boys can't sit still. Boys are reluctant readers. Boys will be boys. And I think we've just got used to seeing boys in these very, very limited ways and limited categories. And we don't even register it as a loss. I think because it's sort of a self-reinforcing logic, because we value masculine qualities above feminine qualities because our society is sexist, we see girls as missing out on those things, but we undervalue those feminine qualities, so we don't see them as a loss to boys.
A listener writes, I have a 3-year-old boy and I'm trying to help him understand that having emotions is normal and trying to nurture his emotional and tender side. My husband is not on the same page. He wants him to be strong and to stop crying. It is a constant conflict. My husband thinks I am being too soft on our son. Why is society so terrified of making him soft?
Yeah, well, this is something that keeps coming up over and over again. I did an event last night and a woman asked a very similar point, which she said, you know, I want to embrace all these softer things, but my husband's scared. And I think the reason why men are scared is because they've grown up with knowing the costs of appearing weak and vulnerable to boys. You know, emasculation is something that boys and men fear because they're taught to fear it. You know, masculinity is this pressure for boys. It's this standard that they're expected to meet. They're expected to prove it and reprove it. And, you know, when they mess up or if they fail to meet that standard, there is still a real social cost. So you can see why men are frightened of this. They grow up with this. They know it firsthand. And I think it's really hard to unpack. Those are very, very deep messages and they're very hard to unpack. And this is like cultural shift that will take time.
Let's go to Pete in Oakland. Pete, you are on the air.
Howdy, Ruth and Leslie. My name is Pete. Again, I've been working in men's circles for dozens of years, or a dozen years at least. But I'm curious, I'd love to hear, Ruth, from your heart, really, what, you know, if you could speak to your younger self, your pre-birthing self, that what would you say to the young women that maybe don't plan on having children? It seems to you've come to this epiphany around men because you've had boys. So I think of the women out there who don't plan on it, or, you know, may hold the relief you held before you had children, and what could you say to your younger self in that context, or those younger women?
That's such a great question. I mean, I think parenting comes with so many joys and so many extremely tough parts, and I think it's an extremely meaningful experience for many people, not for everybody. I like the fact that this generation upcoming now has real choices around this. I think, you know, for a very long time, people had children just because it was what you do. And you know, whether they were ended up being boys or girls, but it was just, you know, what people were expected to do. And so they did it. And I think that now there's a real conversation where people are making an active choice whether to have children or not. And I think that's a really positive thing. But I think, you know, talking about what I would say to my younger self, I think I would just extend myself some grace and say, you know, you don't have that much control. Just, you know, love your boys, try your best, and that's fine.
Good job. all moms out there. A listener on Discord writes, the messaging I got as a kid was all focused on how I had innate bad qualities as a man that would make me sexist. But anytime I spoke up about my feelings, I was shushed by my teachers, and the vast majority of whom were women. It left me with a lot of confusion and self-loathing. And I learned that showing my honest feelings would be punished. It really harmed me, and I second-guessed every single feeling I had. I thought that being attracted to someone physically meant I was shallow. Women also enforce patriarchy. That's a powerful comment. Let's go to Pam in Oakland. Pam, you're on the air.
Hi. Good morning, and thank you for this topic. Two things real quick. I was the mother of a daughter and then a son, so there was 18 months difference between the two, and I was determined to raise them both the same. And when my son was about 2 years old, we were at the park one day, and he picked up a stick and started shooting with it. And we'd never had guns in the house. We'd never talked about guns. I would discourage it if he, you know, but it's like it was there. It was part of his being that he wanted to do that. And I was always surprised by it. And I guess it just has to do with, in part, the difference between, the genetic differences between the sexes. No matter how you raise them, there's going to be differences. My other comment was, I was one of the founders of the Pacific Boy Choir in Oakland, which has music at its foundation. And one of the things that we noticed with our boys that came into our program, into our school, was that they were definitely less mature in the middle school ages than in the elementary ages than the girls around them. And because they didn't have girls with them in the school, they were able to express their emotions, partly through the music that they were learning, I think. I think that's a big part of it. But also because they didn't have to look around and question their thoughts about and their emotions, because there were no girls there that they had to play against, you know, that they had to play against. So that was just really a wonderful thing about what I was able to explore as a teacher, was that the emotional life of the boys in our school and how great it really was.
Beautiful, Pam. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts there. Natalie writes, I am a mom of two boys, 4 years old and 7 years old, and my boys are amazing, and they're rowdy. They bounce off each other like firecrackers, which is a constant stream of joy, fun, conflict, injury, and destruction. I'm struggling with setting limits. My husband and I have very different approaches. He seems to gain control by being more authoritative, stricter, and holding a tighter ship. I am trying to find my way with my own temperament to achieve a similar level of safety for them, but I feel like I'm just getting it wrong. I end up feeling as though the boys don't listen to me, and my efforts to support them emotionally and empathize are just not working. I feel I cannot gain respect or effectively set limits.
This comment just speaks to me so deeply. I feel that this is sort of their headspace that I was really in a few years ago. And what's been really helpful for me was, for so long I was like, you know, yes, my husband has more control. They listen to him. They don't listen to me. All of my things that I'm doing, you know, the empathy and the emotions are irrelevant. They don't care about those. They only want to engage in these boy things. And it really did feel like that for quite a long time. But actually, a few years on, I've really found that all that work that I put in then is really, you know, coming to pass now. It's really, you know, my kids have become so much more emotionally intelligent. Now they've calmed down a little bit and got a bit older. Their brains have matured a bit. All of that early work that I did with them around emotions and feelings and sensitivity, I can see the evidence of it now. And so it takes a long time. I think sometimes we want these immediate results. It's like I know that I wanted instant gratification. I wanted a technique that would work straight away and I could control them. But I think that these things, it's a long game, and these things really do embed, and they're so important. And there's sometimes it's a much longer timeline than you think.
But that's very encouraging. We're talking about what it would mean to reimagine boyhood, reimagine masculinity, and really meaningfully address the crisis of male loneliness, which is a topic we'll get to just after this break. We're talking to Ruth Whitman. She's an essayist, a cultural critic, and an author of the new book, Boy Mom, Reimagining Boyhood in the Age of Impossible Masculinity. She just had an opinion piece out in the New York Times yesterday. We want to hear from you. What does it mean to raise good sons? How do you talk to your sons about masculinity? Please share lessons maybe that you have with the rest of our audience on how you are raising your boys. And do you have any questions for our guests? Email your comments and questions to forum@kqed.org, or you can find us on Twitter, X, Facebook, Instagram. We're at KQED Forum, or just give us a call right now, 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. We'll be right back after this break. Coming up tomorrow on Forum with guest host Guy Marzorati, the influence of the Tea Party on American politics. The right-wing populist movement has lost its funding arm as the conservative group Freedom Works shuts down. And as followers join the MAGA movement, we look at the history of the Tea Party and how it's shaped today's GOP. To listen to past Forum shows, go to Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search KQED Forum. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Leslie McClurg. I'm in today for Mina Kim, and I'm joined by Ruth Whitman. She's an essayist, a cultural critic, and she's the author of the new book, Boy Mom, Reimagining Boyhood in the Age of Impossible Masculinity. And we'd love to hear from you, so if you have any questions or comments for our guests, give us a call now at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. As we sort of planted the seed, I would love to look at how loneliness and unfortunately the rise of suicide is really hitting our young boys. So what does the data say?
Yeah, so there is a real crisis going on with male mental health and male loneliness at the moment, with young male loneliness. There's this statistic that we keep see appearing, which is that a quarter of men under 30 believe that they have no close friends at all. Boys are spending significantly less time socializing in person with their peers than same-age girls are. They're spending more time on screens. And there's many ways in which kind of male social life has kind of migrated online. And I think it speaks to some of the things that we were talking about earlier, that I think boys feel quite shut down from both sides. They feel all of the sort of old systems and pressures of masculinity are still very much in circulation. So all of the, you know, man up, be tough, don't express your feelings, which means that boys find it really hard to kind of express that kind of vulnerability in their friendships and form those very deep connections that I think are much more easily accessible to girls. And some of them are becoming materially more isolated as well. I think boys are becoming quite avoidant of real world socializing. I think it feels so fraught for them, you know, in this moment they're being framed as bad. You know, I think they're very worried about approaching girls in general. That was something I heard across the board from men. So this generation of young men is having less sex than pretty much any generation since researchers started tracking back in the 70s, I think. And you know, when I spoke to men about that, they were saying, you know, the sexual landscape is so fraught for them. You know, they're both expected to be these kind of dominant, aggressive, make the first move, be masculine, show up in that old style manly way. But they mustn't overstep by even the tiniest smidge, and they have to be so cautious, and that they mustn't come off as a creep. And I think they were just like, we just don't know how to be. And it's so much easier just to be in my room on my own and watch porn than, you know, try and be with girls in the real world.
I see a lot of my friends with boys, and they're sort of losing their teenagers to their bedrooms.
Yeah.
Talk about Lucas.
Yeah, so Lucas was, that's not his real name, but that's a boy that one of the boys that I interviewed. I met him at a program down in LA, which is called Guys Group, which it's run by the Teen Therapy Center in LA, which is a great program that works with boys. And it was, a group for them. But he told me, so he was a boy who felt, he was 16 when I spoke to him, and he was extremely lonely. He was spending a lot of his time on Discord. He was involved in all these sort of, there's all these like sex channels that you can be involved in. And he was meeting girls from all over the world. He was, because you can interact. He was having sort of virtual sexual encounters over video. And he felt so much shame. He was so lonely. He felt so marginalized. He didn't know how to find, girlfriends or even really friends in the real world. He, he had a few sort of social engagements, but it would just, he'd go to the bowling league once a week. But most of his time he just spent in his room in these virtual spaces. And I think he just felt so sad and so isolated. And I spoke to another boy when I was doing this research who'd actually spent a lot of time, I call him Aaron in the book, and he was a moderator on a Discord community for gaming. And he told me, I actually write about him in my New York Times op-ed, he told me that there were all these boys, I mean men and women, but mainly boys on the site who were in crisis, and people were calling. He was just kind of a technical moderator on the site, but he started getting calls from all of these boys and young men who were saying, I'm desperate, I'm lonely, I'm feeling suicidal, I don't know what to do. And he developed this reputation as a kind of unofficial therapist on the site, where he would just try to talk to these boys because they felt they had no one to turn to in real life.
A listener on Discord writes, I feel like there's been a backlash by the right in the rise of feminism, and not just Andrew Tate, the manosphere, and the popularity of Trump, which is all hyper-performative, but even in liberal spaces, men need to support each other, but unfortunately, men's rights activists prey on us.
It's true. I mean, I think that the right is exploiting this moment where boys feel very lost, very insecure. The left is not articulating a very positive vision for boys. They're not articulating the message that patriarchy harms boys and men too, and that we're all on the same side. They're sort of framing it in terms of men are the enemy, boys are the enemy. We smash the patriarchy almost as a punishment to boys and men rather than as a service to them. And I think that the right has filled that vacuum. I think it's very hard for boys and men to engage with a political movement that basically saying you're harmful, you suck, you're terrible. They're not gonna come on board with that. And meanwhile, the right and the masculinity influencers and all of those people sidle up to them and say, I can restore you to this manly place of dignity and old school masculine norms. I can give you this thing which you feel, has always been the measure for your worth. And so they're responding to that message. It's very exploitative.
Beth writes, all boys are not one thing, and all girls are not one thing. All people are on a spectrum of being. Until we face and embrace that beautiful diversity of being, we will not get beyond this. Let's go to Shay in Riverside. Shay, you are on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to respond a little bit to, my son is now 30 years old. And when he was growing up, we lived out in the country. It wasn't very, there was no other kids in the neighborhood. He is the second of my two children. My daughter was older. We tried not to hold either of the kids to any of the, like, gender stereotypes. I was just, like, letting them kind of develop who they were. But because there were no other kids around, he spent most of his playtime with his older sister. So there was a lot of storytelling that was going on. There was a lot of, make-believe play, stuff like that. They were using their imaginations a lot also because we didn't have a TV. And so there was books, there was drawing, there was outdoors, there was all of these things that they were doing. And my husband was okay with all of this. He would draw pictures when he got home from work, and he would make up stories with them. And my son was always my emotional child. He was the one that would break down every week and just cry at the end of the week. And we would just kind of like ride with it. You know, we weren't like, big boys don't cry. We never said that.
And so if you fast forward, Shay, today, how is your 30-year-old son?
Well, most people, when he introduces us to his, you know, friends and whatnot, they say to us, you guys need to write a book. You raised an amazing man. What did you do? And we're like, we don't exactly know what we did. We were just trying to let our kids be who they were. And I'll give one quick example. When I was taking my kids shopping one year for like summer clothes, and my son pointed to a little outfit that was like flowers and, you know, all this stuff. And I was like, okay, if you want that, you know. I mean, I was thinking, okay, he's just a little kid. He doesn't know. And I'm not going to put that on him. And I said, well, do you want that? And he said, no. And he shook his head and he pointed to his sister and he wanted it. Beautiful. He wanted that outfit for her. And, you know, it was the only other thing that I did tell my son when he was in high school was I said, please don't be that boy that derails a girl's life, you know.
Well, Shay, it sounds like you've done a really, really beautiful job of raising a really powerful and heartfelt man. So congratulations from one mom to another. A listener on Discord writes, as the son of immigrants who was raised in a blue-collar suburb of Oakland, I found it really hard to fit in. I was called gay just because I was bad at sports, I dressed differently, and I sounded differently. I think the patriarchy needs to be destroyed with a bulldozer, but the dynamics of dating dictate that men need to provide. The dinners, the drinks, and if you put a ring on it, the house, the cars, the vacations, etc. Good point there. Let's go to Shannon in San Francisco. Shannon, you're on the air.
So I was just wondering, like, I'm a male. I was raised with a divorced family. And so I'm a social worker now, and I'm just kind of wondering, like, I have a daughter. And one of the things that I kind of realized is that as an only child and a male with divorced family, I was very free range. but they kind of had this supportive risk taking. And like, I want to kind of instill that on my daughter. Like, I want her to do the things that I did as a male. So I was a combat engineer. And so we shot guns, we went out in the field all the time. And I want her to be able to do that. But I'm kind of confused about this whole sense of the, like, raising a child based off of this binary spectrum, where like you have girls doing one thing, but if they try to step across the line and do those male masculine things, they're looked down upon, and vice versa, you know. And I'm just kind of wondering about that.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point you raise. I mean, I think at this point, I think that was very much the case a while back, that girls were really policed for doing masculine things and, you know, it was seen to be unfeminine. But I think we're doing so much better as a society in encouraging girls to break stereotypes and to embrace those traditionally masculine roles. And there's lots in the culture to support that. But I think the cost for boys is still higher for transgressing. I think there's still a feeling that people feel very squeamish about boys embracing more feminine pursuits. So although there is still a way to go with girls, I feel like we have a better cultural model for allowing them to break through stereotypes than we do have for boys in this moment.
We're talking about what it means to reimagine boyhood and really addressing masculinity and the loneliness that unfortunately is plaguing our boys. We're joined by Ruth Whitman. She's the author of Boy Mom, Reimagining Boyhood in the Age of Impossible Masculinity. You're listening to Forum, and I'm Leslie McClurg in today for Mina Kim. Dorothy writes, I'm the mother of a daughter who from a very young age was not the stereotypical bookish, more subdued little girl, she described. From preschool, she was at least as hyperactive, high energy, and disruptive as the rowdiest boys in her class. Eventually, she was diagnosed with ADHD. But being told she was, quote, too much and, quote, too loud as a girl caused her lasting damage she's still recovering from as a young adult. I imagine that's true for our little boys as well. They're told that constantly.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really true. And I'm glad that somebody raised the sort of flip side of this, which is that girls are policed for that kind of behavior and people do expect it from boys. But on the other hand, I think that there is this feeling among many boys that they're just kind of bad or wrong. And boys get funneled into these disciplinary systems, especially in school, much more frequently than girls. And I think it's sort of this very self-reinforcing problem that because we see boys' problems as behavioral rather than emotional, and we teach them to kind of code all their emotions as anger. We allow them anger and we don't allow them those kinds of sad feelings. And so I think they kind of ramp the behavior up as well, and it becomes this like self-perpetuating problem. But I think a lot of boys do feel like they're somehow wrong in the world, you know, that they're that people look down on them, that they're the less preferred gender, that there's all these negative stereotypes, and it is very harmful.
So confusing too, because then as a woman, we're confused because they often have all of the power.
Right.
We're just in a landscape, which actually this listener, I think, has a great comment on that. I endeavored to raise more egalitarian men. They are in their 40s now, and we continue our conversations. What is difficult to convey is that it's about upholding the best qualities of all genders. It's about making the world kinder, more available to us all. Let's go to Donna in Oakland. Donna, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a 40-year-old son. He was born in 1983, and we did not have access to social media, which I consider a great boon. My goal in raising him was to allow him to express his emotions and not to chide him when he cried or, ignore the tough feelings he was having. And he's turned out to be an amazingly empathetic and engaging and emotionally available father to a 21-month-old little boy.
Yeah, oh, that's beautiful.
It's just a delight to watch.
I bet. That sounds absolutely heartwarming, Donna. Thank you for carrying on that, planting that and seeing that thread carry through into your grandchild. I'm curious, you know, we're nearing the end of the hour, but we haven't even touched on the fact that your three boys are also neurodivergent.
Yes.
So how does all of this apply, and is it the same?
Yeah, so it was a really complicated journey because especially during the pandemic, our boys were very wild. They were, you know, they were struggled with emotional self-regulation. And constantly we had, you know, I had this constant kind of inner conflict, which is just like, is there something going on that's more than just kind of boyish behavior? Are we pathologizing something that's normal for boyhood? Is it a parenting mistake? You know, what's going on? And eventually we got them all assessed during the pandemic. And so my older two boys were diagnosed with ADHD, and all three of them were diagnosed with mild ASD, autism spectrum disorder, very mild. Since then, they've actually all been reassessed because I think some of the things in the pandemic, it was really quite hard to assess those kinds of things in a very neutral way because everybody life was so disrupted and they were so isolated. Since then, it seems like their autism diagnoses are not really valid in the same way, or they don't meet the criteria anymore. The ADHD things, my older two boys do have ADHD and they are on medication for that. And you know, so that is a big piece of it. You know, it's not just boyhood. It is an extra thing going on. But at the same time, so many boys in our culture are being diagnosed with all of these things. You know, it's so much more common now. And it's unclear whether that is because we were underdiagnosing people before, whether we're overdiagnosing them now. It's not, you know, and I think that the narratives of boyhood, you know, boys are wild, boys are hyperactive, they can't sit still, are so closely aligned with the narratives of ADHD anyway that it's really hard to unpack what's what.
A listener writes, I raised two boys as a single mom. When speaking to them on emotional issues, I generally spoke from a female perspective, same with sex education. I also graciously conceded whenever I was off base after listening to them. They are adults with male friends, respect women themselves, and are caring. Good job, Mom. In our final moment here, Ruth, what gives you hope?
Well, the thing that really gave me hope, you know, I spoke to so many boys, older boys, and, you know, I kind of expected them to be these kind of like monosyllabic, kind of lumpish, you know, I thought, oh God, it's going to be a real challenge to interview teenage boys. But they were so lovely and so reflective and so engaged and had so much to say and were so thoughtful that that really gave me hope. I was like, the raw materials are all here. The boys are great. We just need to take these pressures away, to listen to them, to give them some grace. But, you know, they're there. Everything's in place. It's not them that's the problem. It's the society that we're working in.
And as your op-ed said, they're just really deeply craving human connection.
It really is true.
Ruth Whitman is an essayist, a cultural critic, and the author of the new book, Boy Mom, Reimagining Boyhood in the Age of Impossible Masculinity. And for any moms out there, and I'm a mom of a girl, even I could not set this down. I highly recommend her work. Thank you all so much for joining us. Thank you, Ruth, for sharing your thoughts today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Have a wonderful day, everyone.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the